This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and get briefed this week on whether it would be a good idea to make some vaccinations compulsory. But before we start, if you enjoy this podcast, tell a friend or write a review. In the mystic realms of podcast providers, they're the magic dust which help us climb the rankings and help other listeners find us. But enough with the charity appeal. Let's get on with this week's show. Measles is an entirely preventable disease, says the UN. And for a while, we and other developed countries had prevented it through mass vaccination. But during the first 3 months of this year, the World Health Organization reported 112,000 cases of measles. Over the same time last year, it was 28,000. Here in the UK, we once again have outbreaks of measles and falling vaccination rates. Today, in the briefing room, I want to know why this is, how much it matters, and whether, as the Health Secretary has said recently, we should rule nothing out, even including compulsory vaccination. Step inside and we'll find out. First, some context is needed. Gareth Williams, a medical historian, is Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University of Bristol and author of Angel of Death, The Story of Smallpox. Gareth Williams, how and when did the first vaccinations come about?
The first vaccinations were put on the map by a man called Edward Jenner, and he did his great work on vaccination in the late 1790s. What Jenner did to begin with was follow up a legend that is supposed to have trickled up from the farming community, that if you worked with cows, you caught cowpox, you got over it because it was essentially never fatal. And then the miraculous thing which people had noticed was that people had gone through that process could not catch smallpox. And at the time, smallpox was one of the great slayers and mutilators of humanity. He took a deep breath and went on and put his hypothesis to the test. He went out and he got a local case of smallpox. He collected some of the rather disgusting smallpox pus and scratched that into the arm of the child that he'd cowpoxed. And nothing happened. And the reaction was interesting. There was instant understanding by many people. Here was something that genuinely was set to transform the battle against smallpox. But at the same time, there were people who, from the very beginning, took against it. And one of the first arguments was actually that this was a bestial procedure because he was taking stuff from animals and putting that into humans.
So what kind of people were arguing against him?
Well, from the beginning, it was actually men of the church who first of all came out against vaccination. One of the big arguments was that this was a denial of the right of God to determine where and when and how people are going to die. So if God decrees that you, David, are going to die of smallpox next Thursday, and if man comes along with a measure to prevent that from happening, then that's clearly blasphemous. And there was even a convoluted argument also put forward by men of the church that smallpox, revolting though it was, actually served a very useful social function because it tended to kill off the children of the poor. And clearly, if smallpox wasn't operating normally, then healthy upper-class society would be overrun by the children of the poor, who otherwise would have been culled by smallpox. You can extend the same argument to some of the medical objections that came through quite soon after the religious ones. Doctors of the day were earning a very healthy income from not quite interfering with that process. And they saw Jenner's report of vaccination as a big, big threat to them and their income stream.
In terms of public health, what did the authorities attempt to do once they felt that they discovered that vaccination really did work against appalling diseases?
Within a couple of decades, vaccination had spread to Europe, to Russia, to the Americas, a large coverage across the surface of the world. And it was becoming apparent that two things were happening. Firstly, you were not only protecting the individuals whom you had vaccinated, but you were also tending to push the illness itself, the infection, into a corner if you were able to vaccinate enough people in a geographical area.
Is that what we call herd immunity?
That's what became later known as herd immunity, absolutely right.
A lot of people imagine that if you don't vaccinate your children, then the problem is that they might get measles. Now, herd immunity is about something slightly different to that, isn't it?
Yes, herd immunity is a barrier within a population. It describes as the threshold of the percentage of the population who have to be protected against a particular infection. So if you take the case of measles, it's very difficult for measles to spread, to get a foothold, if more than 95% of a geographically defined population are immune. So either they've had measles or they've been vaccinated against it. The threshold varies for different infections. It's particularly high for measles because measles is just a very, very contagious infection. If you ask what do people think is the most horrifically contagious infection, people would probably say the Ebola virus. Well, in fact, the herd immunity threshold for Ebola is actually only about 40%.
So if you had 95% or more of people vaccinated, then gradually you would, as you say, put measles in a corner. You'd actually begin to get no outbreaks and you would have hardly any measles at all.
This is it, because if measles somehow comes in, it's got to break its way through successive rings of immune people, if you like, in order to find enough victims to reach a critical mass and cause an outbreak. But for the population at large, and this is where the notion of herd immunity needs to be reinforced, vaccination is a good thing. And you not only protect the individuals, but again, by preventing the virus from being able to find a way through, that actually then protects other people who haven't been vaccinated.
Now, for a long time, this was seemed relatively uncontroversial. And then we got the Andrew Wakefield case. Can you just explain that in a nutshell?
The Andrew Wakefield thing came out of a paper that was published in The Lancet in 1998. And in it, Wakefield claimed to have found the link between the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and an inflammation of the gut and autism. So what Wakefield proposed was that the reason for the rise in the cases of autism around the world was to do with the expanding use of the MMR vaccine.
Why did this take off?
It was very cleverly exploited. Wakefield himself, although he's a lousy researcher, he's been stripped of his doctor's qualification. He's a very powerful speaker, and he managed to recruit a large number of people to his cause.
And was it as a consequence of that that we saw the first drop for a while below herd immunity levels of vaccination?
Absolutely right. We'd been sailing along at about 95%+ in the UK, and within a couple of years of 1998, when Wakefield's paper came out, it had dropped to 90, and then it dipped below that. And we saw the first cases of measles coming back in the UK a year or so after that. It's not a trivial disease. Around the world, about 110,000 people a year die of measles. And one of the problems with vaccines is that if we forget what the disease was like that we're trying to prevent, then one of the most powerful arguments for using the vaccine melts away.
Professor Gareth Williams. Well, that's the history up to and including the Wakefield affair. But what about today? How bad are things and why have they got that way? Joining me in the briefing room is Professor Heidi Larson, an anthropologist and director of the Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Heidi Larson, we heard earlier about the need for herd immunity and what herd immunity actually is. In the context of measles in the United Kingdom today, what coverage do you need to get herd immunity and what are the trends for it right now?
The level that is needed to protect any country from measles is 95% because it is so highly infectious. It's less for other vaccine preventable diseases, but for measles, it's quite high. And we are in the United Kingdom well below that, particularly in London, which is typically for all vaccines, the lower vaccinating, partly because we have a lot of mobile populations. But in general, it's closer to 90 than 95.
So even running what seem like very small drops in the level of people vaccinated makes a big difference.
Absolutely, particularly with measles. Every single percent makes a significant difference.
Which way's the trend been going?
The trend has been going down the last 4 years, incrementally, not dramatic drops. But, I mean, measles to me is, what do they say, the canary in the mine, because it does flag underlying under-vaccination, which usually is not only measles, it's other vaccine-preventable illnesses, but they may not show up as quickly.
How do you explain this?
The reasons for measles in the UK is a mix of some service delivery issues, some access issues, and also people's hesitancy about vaccines.
You mean in addition to hesitancy, we're actually not always very good at providing vaccine and getting it to the children?
Well, in some places there are some issues with service delivery or access, yes. It's a mix of reasons. Some of the sentiment has been amplified because of the social media environment, because people tend to look for things they're worried about and they find other people that are also worried, and it has this amplification factor. Andrew Wakefield's 1998 now debunked research paper, people forget that his paper came out the same year that Google opened their doors, which was followed a few years later by Facebook, by YouTube, the whole lot. These things are not unrelated. You get something that is sticks in people's minds, and then they're on the heels of a totally changed communication environment.
So do you mean that if you, let's say, you were to push into your search engine, are vaccines dangerous, or is there a link between vaccine and X or Y, you're pretty likely to find yourself sent to sites that say that there are?
Absolutely. One of the things right now, one of the actions that are being taken is to sit down with some of these technology companies and say, let's look at the algorithms and try to mitigate the path that people are led to get more concerned rather than less concerned.
Now, let's talk about the kinds of people who are vaccine resistant, who have now decided effectively to take their children out of vaccination.
Well, I would say there are three dominant themes. One is safety anxieties, particularly as we see less of the prevalent diseases that vaccines are preventing.
You mean people have literally forgotten what these diseases look like?
Exactly. So one is safety. The second is we call liberty and purity. Liberty is the anti-mandate issue.
By mandates, we mean making them mandatory, making them compulsory effectively.
That's less of an issue here because we haven't had the mandates, but that's something that does affect people's reaction. And then the last one, but I would put it as one of the growing number one issues, is a growing trend, particularly among younger mothers, towards pro-nature. It's part of a whole cluster of paleo or gluten-free diets, not taking contraceptive and going rhythm method. And then within that is the idea of a vaccine-free childhood. It's almost like a, not an anti-vaccine sentiment, but a pro-something else sentiment. It's not religious, but it's an alternative belief about the health of children.
And are there religious communities actually who do hold anti-vaccine views or that vaccination is an unwarranted interference?
There are some groups, less so in the UK, although, I mean, we have what they call the Bible Belt in the Netherlands. In the US, we have Amish groups, different groups. With the Muslim community, sometimes there's issues around vaccines that have gelatin, porcine, and it has a remote relation to pigs. So there's some issues there.
How much much suspicion is there amongst some groups of medical consensus?
I think trust is really the issue that is waning, let's say. And I think it's also broadly with officials and elites, not just with vaccines. And I think part of that is also driven by the fact that because of all this access to information, people feel like they have alternative sources, that they have more agency, more opportunity to decide for themselves. And we've even seen in interviews with young mothers that they feel responsible to do that. And if they haven't challenged their doctors, I've heard some say they didn't sleep at night because they just blindly accepted what the doctor said.
Does it make it difficult that it's actually very hard to evaluate risk? I mean, no one can say that a vaccine is 100% safe, because nothing is 100% safe. But as soon as you say it's not, then in that case, you create a risk calculation on the part of the parent, which they may not be terribly well qualified to make.
That's absolutely correct. I have had conversations with people who say they're not 100% safe, and actually it's a place I can agree with them and say, you're right, it's not 100% safe. And you can say it's one in a million, but from a mother's perspective, they care about the one. But I think what people don't take into account is the risks of not vaccinating. And there are a lot of psychological studies that talk about omission bias, that by not doing something, you feel like you're taking less risk, when in fact, by not vaccinating, some of these mothers are taking more risk. And some of the alternative health approaches, they also have their risks.
What proportion, as far as you can tell, of the population falls into the categories either of highly vaccine resistant, highly vaccine accepting, and then doubtful, unsure, worried, don't know?
In general, when we do our global research and our global confidence index, I would say you might have 10% in the very anti, 5-10% in the really anti, and then probably 15-20% in the pro-vaccine. And then the rest are probably vaccinating but having questions. And we should not by any means discourage parents from asking questions. It's an absolutely responsible thing to do. And the thing that worries me about this polarization of anti-vax versus pro-vax is that it leaves out the most important group that we really need to build the confidence with and make room to answer those questions before they feel shut out and then become more anti-vaccine.
How does that best happen?
I think starting with just the straightforward correction of a lot of the misinformation out there is a start, without putting a lot of judgment on it, pro or con. Just say, listen, these are the real risks, these are the real benefits of this. I know that facts alone will not change people's minds, but if we have that conversation when they're in the early stage of questioning, there's much more opportunity to get people to at least think twice before they refuse.
What you're talking about really is a relatively new culture for, say, medicine in Britain, collective public health medicine in Britain, because when I was a kid, it was very much you just do what everybody else does.
Yeah, it's absolutely a culture change. And I think there's a lag between where the public is and where the health professionals are and science in general that we need to catch up.
One of the arguments that you hear from parents who do vaccinate is, why should my children and other people be put at risk because these relatively small group of other people won't do what they should be doing? Shouldn't we be making sure that at the very least, children who go to school with our children are vaccinated?
Well, in the ideal world, you know, you'd want people to just vaccinate because the science demonstrates the value of it. But that's not happening everywhere. And I think that deciding about a mandate very much depends on how infectious the particular disease you're trying to prevent is. In the case of measles and, say, influenza pandemics, those are highly infectious viruses. Measles stays in the air for a couple of hours after the infected person leaves the room. It's highly infectious. So in certain cases, I think it should be seriously considered. You know, your first line is to try to strengthen where there are weak spots in the system before you bring in a mandate. And then if it's still a problem, then consider that.
Professor Heidi Larson, even contemplating moving to some form of compulsion in vaccination seems a big step, both practically but also ethically. If I were Health Secretary for England or Wales or Scotland, I'd want advice on the issues it raises. So joining me in the studio is Hugh Whittle, Director of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, an independent body that examines and reports on ethical issues in biology and medicine. And down the line from our Cambridge studio is Dr. Stephen John, a lecturer in the philosophy of public health at the University of Cambridge. Stephen John, is getting your child vaccinated a private matter?
I think it must be one where a state is entitled to intervene. It's a complex issue, but think about it this way. I can't make choices about your healthcare, so I can't choose whether you have some treatment, even if that has effects on other people. By contrast, typically we can make lots of choices about our children, but that discretion isn't unlimited. I can't send my seven-year-old out to work, for example. And I think that those limits are important, and vaccination is a case where the state can intervene in the parent's decision, yes.
Now, that's quite interesting. You raised the distinction between what you could require an adult to do and what you would require someone to essentially get their children to do.
Yes. I mean, this is complicated, but typically we do give parents an awful lot of discretion. And typically we do that, I guess, on the basis of two assumptions. One is that parents really care about what's best for their kids. And one is that parents know what's best for their children. But of course, there are cases where parents don't know best. And I think vaccination might be one of those cases.
Hugh, what do you think the ethical considerations are which we should weigh up when deciding whether or not to make parents vaccinate their children?
Well, we might start with the underlying responsibilities that we attribute to both the state and to individuals and potentially to others, and where the role of the state would be to promote good health amongst the population, individuals as well as groups, but also to prevent harm as well. And so the extent to which the state might have either the legitimate power to intervene or the responsibility to intervene is one starting point. But at the same time, individuals have responsibilities not just for their own children, but also within their communities. And so we've got these questions of protection of autonomy and of privacy and of self-concern that may be in tension with those other responsibilities to wider populations. And so this is the question about how you manage that potential tension.
Now, I can imagine two different parents. The one that says, look, if I judge that it's not something that I want my child to do, then you really shouldn't be enforcing it upon me. And then you have the parent that says, your child is coming into a school with my child, and I want my child to have some degree of protection against this situation. How do we go about ethically weighing up the claims of those two different people, Stephen John?
It's a good question, and I think it depends a lot on the actual risks involved, as well as people's belief about the risks. So, of course, there could be cases where a parent doesn't want a child to come into a school, but that is based on some superstition or prejudice. What's important in this case, the vaccination case, is that the child who isn't vaccinated does pose a risk. And I think it's about fact of a risk which is important, not so much what the people believe about it or feel about it.
Hugh Whittle, does the scale of the risk matter?
Indeed. I think we can look at the scale of the risk in terms of the kind of numbers involved, but also the severity of the harm that might be at stake and what kind of disease and prevention that we're looking at taking. And then we can appeal to people both in terms of the facts and the evidence of that, but also in terms of their values. So one might have a private interest in one's own individual child, but I think we also share an interest in the common values and the community aspect of working with other neighbours and other members of our community.
Stephen John, what's your instinct when it comes to how people would respond to mandated vaccination in the UK today?
Look, it's very hard to predict, of course, because we have cases where things have been mandated in the past, and at first they were controversial, but they've become commonplace very quickly.
What would be examples?
So an example might be the smoking ban in public places. So people can change their views very quickly. But I think in the vaccination case, there are two complicating factors. One is precisely that we feel so strongly that we get to choose for our children. But this is a special kind of intrusion in the private sphere in a way in which stopping people smoking isn't. The second issue, of course, is that people have reasons to resist vaccination. And often people have very strong beliefs that the vaccine is unsafe. So I think that any attempt to make vaccination mandatory would first have to engage very fully with people's reasons against vaccination.
Hugh.
I think that's entirely correct. But we also have to think, before we move to that mandatory stage, what are those reasons? What are the reasons why some communities are not engaging with vaccination programs? And sometimes it's because they are simply not accessing health services generally. So it may be that we first look at the burden being upon the state and the administration to reach those people with that kind of information that will support the vaccination programs. But also to understand if, for example, the mandatory aspect is that children are only allowed into schools if they've been vaccinated. People may, we may find empirically, that they delay vaccination until the day before they enter school, when actually a much earlier vaccination would be much more protective.
Stephen, are there any other possible perverse side effects of mandatory vaccination?
I think, at least in some communities, that people just start to disappear from the sight of a state, as it were. They would prefer to maintain privacy, to maintain liberty, in ways which mean that they withdraw from health services, from education services, from social services. And then the more general anticipated side effect is we are already seeing all sorts of concerns about expertise, about the state and the experts somehow being in cahoots and somehow imposing their will upon the people. And the worry is that when you move towards a mandatory system in a situation where people are worried, you might see a larger breakdown of trust in the medical system. And that, of course, could well be disastrous.
OK, I'm going to ask you both to actually make a choice here. I'm the Secretary of State. I'm looking at the problem of measles outbreaks, and I'm looking at the fact that we seem to be not just losing herd immunity, but vaccination uptake is very gradually reducing. I'm wondering whether actually the time has come for some form of mandated vaccination in some form or other. Hugh Whittle, should I do it?
In the UK at this time, probably not. We need to be alert, we need to be concerned, we need to redouble our efforts in those areas of the country where vaccination rates have fallen, but there's more that we can do before moving to mandatory.
Stephen John.
I agree with Hugh. Moving directly to a mandatory system is probably not justified at the moment. We don't know what will be effective, and we don't know enough about why precisely people don't vaccinate. Having said that, however, it's important to remember there are lots of steps between our current system and a fully mandatory system. So we could, for example, offer more incentives to get vaccinated. We could make it far easier. We could make it far more routine as part of normal care without going all the way to bringing in full mandatory vaccination.
How bad would things have to get before you thought it was necessary?
I think that we have to see a scale and a severity that, in terms of proportionality, and this is where the judgment comes in, is it a proportionate step? Having taken the kind of approaches that Stephen has already outlined in terms of reaching people with better information, I think it's a judgment that is really tough.
Stephen.
It's very easy to put these kinds of risks off screen because we don't see them happening, and only to respond once there's a problem. That's too late. So what there does need to be then is there needs to be constant monitoring and an awareness of just when we think the risk, the probability is high enough. But then it's time to take a further step towards mandatory vaccination.
Dr. Stephen John there from Cambridge University and Hugh Whittle of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. My thanks to them and also to Professors Gareth Williams and Heidi Larson. And we'll be back next week at the same time. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Richard Fenton-Smith and Serena Tarling. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. Other programmes we've done on medical themes include last week's on the opioid crisis and an earlier programme on antibiotic resistance.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.